Good morning. Another week, another vaccine row. Or rather, the exact same vaccine row as last week and the week before. But eventually settled in what the EU and the UK would describe as a win-win. So no to a full-blown blanket EU vaccine export ban. Now it's a case of a tweak, a gentle redistribution, if you will. But only after, play nice, or we'll get nasty. Here's Europe editor Tony Connolly on Thursday's Morning Ireland.
The EU is looking at the potential of preventing perhaps tens of millions of AstraZeneca vaccine doses from going to the UK. And also at the same time, the European Commission has brought in new restrictions on vaccine exports, which could also see Pfizer doses prevented from going to the UK. So I think, you know, as one diplomat said, the EU has kind of put a gun on the table in these discussions. And that may be why there is a move now to some kind of agreement with the UK. They haven't spelled out the details, as you say, but they talked about a solution in the short, medium and long term. And when they talk about the short term, one assumes that they're talking about this stockpile, if you like, of AstraZeneca doses that the UK is expecting, but which the EU says, look, they should really go to Europe, even though the European contract with AstraZeneca may not be quite as hard as the UK contract. Our citizens are dying and we need those vaccines.
On Thursday evening, EU leaders held an informal virtual summit which gave qualified support to these potential restrictions. But legally, just how far could the EU go?
It still leaves the question, you know, what happens? Because the Commission has accepted that it can't seize doses that might be going from AstraZeneca facilities to the UK. The Commission has only blocked one export of vaccines, and that was 250,000 doses from Italy to Australia. But it wasn't like the EU could then take those doses and give them to European countries. The legal situation is that those doses still belong to AstraZeneca. So this is all kind of political and moral pressure.
So a disapproving frown and the waggy finger. Of course, the EU had exported more than 10 million doses to the UK. The UK in return? Zilch. Galling maybe, but while all the ire might well be directed at the UK, when it came to AstraZeneca, had the EU failed to read the small print? On Wednesday, Claire spoke to Professor specialising in EU law Gavin Barrett from UCD's Sutherland School of Law.
Do we know why AstraZeneca is doing this?
The reason seemed to be contractual for it. In evidence given to the European Parliament there in May 2020, Pascal Soriot, the AstraZeneca CEO, said that the UK priority comes from a research funding agreement that Oxford signed with the UK government in January or February 2020. Now, we haven't seen that agreement because it's been kept confidential by the United Kingdom government. But essentially what it means is that the United Kingdom government locked AstraZeneca into an arrangement which nobody knew about, essentially, whereby the vaccines that are produced by AstraZeneca, the UK gets all of its needs supplied before anyone else in Europe gets theirs supplied.
So the EU made a misstep?
You can put it that way, but the European Union were not made aware of that particular arrangement. I don't think they would have reached the arrangement they did with AstraZeneca if they knew that they were going to behave in the manner in which they have done. And it's quite interesting because Boris Johnson has said that we in this country don't believe in blockades of any kind of vaccines or vaccine material. It's not something this country would dream of engaging in. In fact, by virtue of the contractual arrangements that he has reached with Oxford and which have been inherited by AstraZeneca, that's exactly what is happening, because vaccines which have been bought and paid for by European Union countries, including Ireland, are not being exported to them.
But given the massive gap in rollout between the EU and other countries, primarily the UK and the US, it's worth a quick reminder of how all this went down last year. Here's Tony Connolly again, this time from Tuesday's News at One, reporting on a briefing from the EU's chief vaccine negotiator, Sandra Gallina.
When the European Commission negotiated these contracts last year, these vaccines didn't yet exist. So member states were asking the Commission to negotiate on their behalf for things that were not guaranteed to appear or to be effective. And the initial approach by the Commission was that they would negotiate volumes of vaccines, of vaccine doses, on a pro rata basis. So in other words, each country would get an amount based on its population. Now, she said this morning that a number of member states, in fact, the trend last year was for member states to ask for less than the pro rata allocation because they didn't know if these vaccines were going to be successful. And in a sense, they were kind of hedging the risk, not wanting to spend a lot of money on something which might not ever materialise. And then a number of other member states agreed to, as she put it, soak up the extra doses that were not being used theoretically by those member states. And that was going to mean that the price would stay the same because, say, Pfizer had a certain price for 200 million doses. If that total amount fell because of member states not using the full allocation, then the price would go up. So a number of member states said they would take the soak up, as she said, the extra vaccines to keep the price cheap for member states.
So bulk buy to get a good price seems smart. However, not everyone was in agreement. Also on the line was Guntram Wolf, director of Bruegel, the Brussels-based think tank, and he felt that the EU had not done its best work here, too slow off the blocks, without suitable institutions for purchase and distribution, and this.
So clearly the decision to centralise these purchases was taken quite late. It was taken only in the summer of last year, when other countries such as the US or the UK were already in full swing negotiating with the pharma companies, building up a whole full-blown strategy. And also, let's be honest, institutionally the European Commission didn't have the right staff for this kind of operation. And so I think these mistakes explain partly why it's been so late. Last point, really, the member states wanted to, as so often is the case in Europe, on the one hand wanted to delegate the task, on the other hand wanted to sit there around the table and take all relevant decisions themselves. And this decision-making by committee is just slow. It leads to the lowest common denominator instead of what would have been needed, a bold and risk-friendly and a big strategy.
So what should the EU do? Block exports to the UK entirely? Or might that just inflame the situation?
Now, the question is whether strategically, in the end, it will help or not. And there I'm actually quite close to, I guess, what the Irish government is saying. I think there is a real risk that this would lead to a tit-for-tat trade war in vaccines, and EU producers are really dependent also on core inputs from the UK for their production capacity. So the possible damage is very big. The possible upside is quite low.
Guntram Wolf in Brussels. Certainly Taoiseach Micheál Martin came out quite strongly against an export ban. No messing there. But surely the moral imperative to share vaccines should hold some sway. Back to Law Professor Gavin Barrett with Clare, who went so far as to cite the famine. Yes, the famine.
The European Union feels that they have, other member states feel that they have been made fools of, essentially, here. I mean, the best analogy I can draw here is in relation to UK behaviour. Someone in a village who accepts the generosity of his neighbours during a famine, and then when he's asked to share his own food, says, no, this legally belongs to me. Now, perhaps he has the law with him, but the conduct is still morally reprehensible at the end of the day. And the other member states, particularly France and Germany, have had enough of it.
Well, one person who agreed with that viewpoint was John O'Brennan, Jean Monnet Professor of European Integration at Maynooth University. He spoke to Clare on Monday and went head to head with Conservative MP Andrew Bridgen. They had what is best described as a frank exchange of views or an almighty scrap. Here's how it started.
The United Kingdom has twice breached or threatened to breach a solemn legal agreement with the European Union, forcing the EU to take legal action only weeks after Brexit happened. The Conservative government has also awarded contract after contract to Tory insiders during the COVID crisis, and with virtually zero parliamentary scrutiny. And Boris Johnson, let's remember, has spent his entire career telling untruths about the EU. When I was growing up, the UK had a global reputation for probity, for good governance, for being a reliable partner. That has plummeted in recent years, and that is the big problem, I think, okay, in the UK-EU relationship. The lack of trust is absolutely profound.
Into the ring, Andrew Bridgen, who defended AstraZeneca and then called out John O'Brien.
Before we start this interview, I heard the tirade from the learned professor, John. Given his area of research and expertise, would I be correct in surmising that he's funded by the European Union for this research? And in the interest of transparency, would he reply to that so that the listeners know where he's coming from?
John?
Andrew is the genius who back in 2018 suggested that all English people were entitled to Irish passports merely because of the common travel area. I leave it up to listeners to decide who has credibility on these issues.
That sounded like a deflection there, John. Never mind. The EU's position is completely untenable, which is why they've rolled John out as their paid advocate to defend them. The fact that Merkel and Macron both made untrue statements, which are tremendously damaging to Oxford AstraZeneca, a vaccine which was fully funded by the UK taxpayer, all the research, and was being given to the world for £3 a dose, the cost of production, and yet they claimed it was ineffective on over 65s, that's been debunked. They've claimed it gives blood clots, that's been debunked. The coordinated suspension of the use across the European Union of the vaccine, which would save lives. Effectively, the European Commission playing politics, EU politics, over people's lives, and that is indefensible.
Fight and talk from Conservative MP Andrew Bridgen with Clare. But that was Monday. And now we do have a peace of sorts, or at least not all out war. That win-win, as the joint statement put it. But how is all this playing out in the UK against the backdrop of Brexit? Former EU Ambassador to Washington David O'Sullivan spoke to Anya on Thursday's Morning Ireland.
Very polarised coverage if you look at the difference between European media and UK media in the way this whole row over vaccine supplies has been covered. How dangerous this mix of jingoism, vaccine nationalism and Brexit?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was an element of vaccine jingoism in the UK media and on the part of some politicians. I hope that we can put that behind us because it is dangerous and it is unhelpful. The vaccine success in the UK is really very little to do with Brexit and everything to do with the fact that they started sooner and frankly, the very great efficiency of the NHS, and full credit to them, and they deserve credit for what they've been able to do. I think we need to learn some lessons, the rest of us in Europe, because it's not just the supply, it's also the logistical rollout of the vaccines, which is still posing problems in member states. But hopefully, I thought the statement last night between the UK and the EU was actually the most positive statement that we've seen since the whole Brexit debate began. So maybe this recognition of mutual interdependence will help tone down the rhetoric and help us actually to try and work together.
Ooh, you've got to hope so. And at this stage, it's all eyes on the second quarter, the magic second quarter. This is the one. No, really, honest, she will be swimming in the jab. We'd settle for paddling any day now. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Thank you. Bach's solo cello suite performed by Mark Coppi as heard on Arena, ahead of the Cellissimo Festival. Absolutely gorgeous. Now, living our best life, are we? No pressure there. On Thursday, Matt Haig spoke to Oliver about his novel The Midnight Library, which tells the story of wishing for a better life, but maybe making peace with the one you have. And this particular line stood out for Oliver.
Maybe that's what all lives were. Maybe even the most seemingly perfectly intense or worthwhile lives ultimately felt the same. Acres of disappointment and monotony and hurts and rivalries, but with flashes of wonder and beauty. So,
yeah, we kind of need the darkness, I think, sometimes to see the light, isn't it? That's how we see the stars in the sky. Yeah. And I get very sentimental about this because obviously I went through, like a lot of people, I went through experiences of depression. I was suicidal for a good deal of time. And I would never in a million years want to relive those sort of darkest days. But I also think by the same token that without that experience, I would not have known so much happiness and gratitude in the present. So I feel like we kind of need it together. You know, we know what happiness is and contentment is and calmness is because we also know what the opposite is. And that is part of life. And we can't sometimes separate the one from the other. And that's actually quite healing to come to terms with that.
Yeah, to even just slow down and consider that exactly. As something. But it's full of those little nuggets. And also you do some great quotes as well. The life of a human, according to the Scottish philosopher David Hume, was of no greater importance to the universe than that of an oyster.
Yeah, he was apparently really fun at dinner parties as well, thank you.
And we also got a life lesson from the Stoics.
It was a very enjoyable book, as well as just having, kind of the timeless message that finding meaning in the suffering, and when you can change your circumstances, maybe you can change your attitude towards them.
Yeah, no, totally. And, last year I got into a lot of the old Stoic philosophy, like the ancient Greeks, and there was this guy called Epictetus, I think that's how you pronounce it. Anyway, he was a slave and eventually a freed slave, and he came up with basically the ancient version of like cognitive behavioral therapy. He was like, you cannot change the external things. All we can change is our responses to them. And it's a hard place to get to that place, but once you do, I think that's where freedom is.
Writer Matt Haig with Oliver. Meanwhile,
I want to get inside a cat's head.
Of course he does. Luckily though, Ray was talking to Alice Chow, animal behavioralist and cat detective. Yes, cat detective. And as it happens, she did have an insight into these most mysterious of creatures.
One of the most unusual domestic animal, because the thing is, we are not even sure they're domestic.
Ah.
So basically, we have never actually made them to live with us. They chose to live in us, and they still choose to live with us every day. If anyone who have cats will know, if you open the door, they manage to go out and find their own food and find their own shelter, and some cats do. But the fact that your cat comes home to you every day, we know that they like people. To choose us and choose to live with us is crazy.
And if you panic that your cat is missing, stuck up a tree, down a drain, in mortal danger, prepare yourself for a tricky home truth.
You will hear people saying that my cat was missing for 3 weeks and then he came back. Well, that cat wasn't missing per se. That cat actually moved in with someone. It's not like your cat was missing. Your cat was just at your neighbor. That's usually what happens.
So are cats polyamorous? Would they be loyal to a number of families?
It's not every single cat, but it's not uncommon that the cat have several families, because there are statistics showing with a GPS device attached to the cats that we find out that very often the cat might have 3 to 5 families.
Okay.
Up to 5.
Up to 5? That is harsh. But if indeed your cat is missing and they do stray, assuming they're not having a sleepover, what should you do? Not, it seems, what most people do.
I would say like 99% of the people are doing this wrong. The first line of action people do is that they lost their animal. So they go out to the garden and say, you know, Muffin, They're just screaming and trying to get them to come back in. They won't come in. I'll explain why the psychology they won't come in. And the second thing people would do is they go on Facebook or any social media and just say, hey, missing part, please share, please blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Now, the thing is, the more energy you spend on this, the more time you're wasting, because the cat is not on Facebook. He can't read this. the cat is just out there somewhere. You need to go and look for the cat. The last sighting, did the neighbor see her? Did she go to the pub? Whatever. You know, you go out to do something instead of sitting in front of the computer.
That's us told. And finally, the age-old question.
Will you settle this, or maybe you don't know? Are cats more intelligent than dogs?
I don't know.
You don't know, okay.
I can't know for sure, but I do think that they express differently because they don't have much facial expression.
Yeah.
But I have seen every day that the cat tried to train the human to do things they want.
Deliciously manipulative creatures. That was Alice Chow with Ray on Tuesday. On Culture File, Kevin Brew talked to us about the consolations of cheap pop music.
There's the music you admit to liking, and the secret tears you've saved for pop songs in restaurants during dinner by yourself. I remember Karma Chameleon and how it made me quake in the back of the car on the way to school. Soon the song would end, and I'd have to face multiplication tables and a new teacher. And the song seemed to be about that dread, even though it was more about a lover changing spots. Every breath you take, the winner takes it all. Feelings, whoa, whoa, feelings. These audio epiphanies won't work if the song is cool. It's the lack of cool that makes these audible embraces burst out among the masses and up the charts. The stars sing the hook and take it up a semitone for the final triumphant version of the chorus. These songs feel like hugs after rows in the kitchen, when the persona you've built up needs to be destroyed to live with love. When your aspirational, non-existent self, who accepts loads of awards and has a perfectly taut belly, is stripped down to someone more recognisable, who digests food, who pulls up weeds, who is slightly too warm when leaning against another forehead to say sorry. Then there's the music you don't like, but maybe it works its magic on someone important. This means you've to open your ears to everything. James Last, Daniel O'Donnell, a jukebox of cheesiness that makes you cringe. Then, while you wait at your table for one in the restaurant, has the waiter forgotten you? Cyndi Lauper sings time after time, and you realise that pop will always melt your heart.
Kevin Brew on Culture File. And if he loves cheap and nasty pop, for Oliver, it's all about Home of the Year.
We're obsessed, you see, with houses and property in this country. And sure, why not? Weren't we dispossessed by the Sassani? So we cling to the land and the houses in honour of our fathers and forefathers and foremammies. The Americans have their guns, but we have our kitchen islands and soft clothes drawers and gigantic stoves that'll just burn everything that we have. Now, very importantly, the other controversial topic that gets us going is the weather, because apparently people looking up with noses a ring around the moon, especially in Cork, apparently, because it's always, you know, it's always better. Everything's better in Cork. So Astronomy Ireland said it's caused by ice crystals high in the atmosphere. Well, so what does it mean about the weather? The halo is often seen before a period of low pressure. Folklore would say they appear before a storm. There you go, moon halos. What would Amanda Bone think of moon halos? I don't like moon halos. It just interferes with the space.
I love a good moon halo. If I could get a halo, I would drape it over my shoulders.
Stop it, you've had enough now.
Oh, back in a bit. Welcome back. Technology, faith, conspiracy, and yes, aliens all collided across a few different programmes this week. On Arena, Patrick Chapman spoke about the unsettling and provocative films of David Cronenberg. Films like The Fly, Crash, Dead Ringers, and the 1983 film Videodrome.
What is Cronenberg, what kind of critique do you think he was making about media? And while video wasn't exactly social media, you can kind of see it as the precursor to the type of social media that we're dealing with today.
Well, we now have more technology as an extension of our bodies today. Anyone who, you know, people forget that you need to be able to afford access to a computer to engage in this new society. But back then they had analog. But these people who are behind the signal in this movie trying to impose a new flesh are basically talking about a trope that's common in Cronenberg's work, which is that of creative destruction. And that is a creative act is a destructive act. So if you want to create something new, you have to kill off something that already exists. And that's quite a radical idea in some senses, because it's very year zero. Mm. And the long live the new flesh, like in The Fly, Brundle loses his old flesh and becomes a new thing. Or earlier in his career, he had parasites taking over apartment buildings, and that was a happy thing for the parasite. It's really an uncompromising approach.
Yeah, you've touched on it there, that it was a happy thing for the parasite. How nihilistic is that vision, you know, that for something new to be created, something else must be destroyed? You can look at that in a positive way. It does sound quite nihilistic, but not necessarily is it so.
Well, he's always said that from the point of view of the parasite, a widespread infection is a happy outcome. And it really does depend on changing your point of view.
Oh, that's an interesting head flip. That was Patrick Chapman on Arena. And technology and society were on the mind of actor and writer David Duchovny, who spoke to Brendan on Sunday. His novel, Truly Like Lightning, centres on a man of faith who removes his family from a society that he feels is failing. And for Duchovny, this had echoes in his own life and his views on technology and social media. But perhaps 'twas ever thus.
You know, I started to think, okay, I'm railing against telephones and cell phones and the modern world. And then I realized, you know, this has happened to every step of technology, every leap forward technologically has been met with this kind of fear that it's going to ruin humanity. And you could start with the printing press, you know, and making the Bible itself as an object, as a printed object available to everyone, you know, and that this was a terrible thing. And then you go to the novel, which is stories about regular people, middle class and lower class people. And this was considered an affront to everyone's sense of what the world should be like. Before that, we had epic poems about kings and queens. And now we have the phone and we're saying the same thing. So I don't know. I think what's going to happen is the world will change and it'll be a different world. And it'll be one that I don't recognize quite as well.
Now, David was on to talk about the book, but Brendan saw him as an actor. And bravely, he was upfront about his misgivings.
Listen, I'm going to admit something to you now. I approached Truly Like Lightning with a bit of trepidation. I thought, oh God, here we go. A Hollywood guy wants to write a novel and somebody indulged him. And then I started reading it and it's great. And then I looked into you and I realised that you're actually not an actor turned writer. The literature came first for you, didn't it?
Yes, I'm a writer turned actor. And in fact, when I first started auditioning in Los Angeles, I'm just remembering this now, but my agents and manager would say, you know, don't mention that you went to Princeton and Yale because then people will, I don't know, not so much be intimidated, but kind of question your motive. Like, why is he acting? You know, so now I get the reverse, which is why is he writing? But in fact, it is something. My dad was a writer. I've always known, and in fact, I got into acting thinking I would write plays. That was the initial foray for me was, I was thinking, oh, I want to write plays, but then maybe I should know what it means to stand up there and say somebody else's lines. And that's how I kind of got interested in acting.
And Duchovny had done his undergraduate thesis on Beckett, no less.
I wrote on Murphy, Malone Dies, The Unnameable, and Watt, even. I don't know if anybody reads Watt, but I did.
But when it came to acting, he had to slightly park that side of his brain.
So to go back to when you were going for auditions initially and everything, did you kind of have to act dumb, was it?
Well, no. I mean, it's like, I don't know. It is a stereotype that actors are dumb, you know. But here, I'll tell you one thing that is true and one thing that I had to personally fight through is that, you know, I had spent a great part of my life up until that point, in the age of 26, 27, when I started acting, was really academic. And it's not so much an instinctual discipline. It's a mental, it's a rigorously mental discipline. So acting is very much instinctual. You know, you don't want to come into it weighed down by your brain. You want, you know, of course you use your brain, certain aspects of it, but you want to be animalistic. You want to be an instinctual reacting thing as well.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of baggage that I had given myself, you know, that I had worked on this one muscle of mine to the exclusion of others. And so in reality, it was very liberating for me when I started acting. I mean, not just in the sense of working, but in the sense of becoming a more full human being, a more complete human being, and not just kind of a brain.
Yeah. Leave the big brain at the door when you want to come in here acting, Duchovny.
And you can't talk to Fox Mulder, sorry, David Duchovny, without mentioning this.
Is there an X-Files, do you think, that fits into the world now? Because, like, in a way, conspiracy theorists used to be marginalised kind of cranks, and now they're much more part of the mainstream, aren't they?
Yeah, it's really an odd turn of events that I remember back, you know, in the early midst of doing the show. We kind of became aware of this thing called the internet through chat rooms devoted to the X-Files and things like that. And I remember thinking, oh, this is not going to come to any good. And, you know, obviously Mulder was, you know, like one of the original conspiracy guys. And you know, thinking back on that, you know, he's almost an innocent, you know, now that we're where we're at.
The truth is out there. Bringing us nicely to Wednesday's Live Line.
All I can say for certain is that beings from other worlds have visited this Earth, and I continue to do so.
Aliens. And when it comes to mysterious sightings, Paddy in County Meath is the man. Joe, on the other hand, not buying it.
Okay, now, Paddy, you're playing handball off a haystack here with me because I've no belief whatsoever in this.
I wouldn't blame you, Joe, because it's crazy bonkers, to say the least of it.
Well, you take us back to when you first believed you saw something. The year is 1959.
The year is 1959, and I was just turning 14. And as usual, on a summer's evening, I was out with my brother and one friend, as it happened, out on the field out in front of our house. I turned around and looked over towards a low hill. There was a disc, a blood-red disc, a glowing blood-red disc, about 100 feet in altitude over the hill. And I'd say it had to be about 60 foot in diameter. From memory, and I can still see it now. Exactly, it's imprinted on my mind exactly if it only happened 5 minutes ago.
And Paddy had called in on foot of former intelligence director for Donald Trump, John Radcliffe, speaking about an upcoming report detailing UFO sightings that he says will be difficult to explain. And certainly Paddy's close encounters were many. He talked about another strange visitation. He woke one night about 2:30 to see an unusual beam of light.
There was heavy dark curtains, a brownie colour, and I noticed a light on the curtains. The amazing thing that happened was that light started to grow in intensity, slowly in intensity, until the curtains became a milky white glow. And here's where it becomes absolutely bonkers. That white glow turned into a white milky mist and started to come towards me in the bed. And at this stage, I realised I should give my wife a nudge, who was beside me. And when I tried to do it, lift my arm, I was paralysed. I couldn't move my arm. And the next thing I know, I was out. I was gone. I remembered nothing until the next morning.
And Joe asked this.
Do you believe there are aliens among us?
I do, yes.
And their incarnation owed just a little bit to Hollywood.
Men in Black.
Yeah, well, these are the movies.
Well, I tell you, Joe, it's for real. That's for real. People didn't make that up. Because I've seen those on two occasions. Now, I haven't had contact with them, but...
What did the Men in Black look like? Don't say Men in Black.
Well,
and how would you know? How would you know these Men in Black are aliens?
Instinctively, if you looked at their features and you'd have a sixth sense, your instinct would tell you that they weren't human. You remember Kojak, Telly Savalas?
Yeah, Kojak, lollipop.
Well,
yeah.
Well, if you visualise Telly Savalas' face, only longer or narrower. And a sort of a North African mahogany brown with a blank stare, wearing a black hat and black clothes. And if you saw two of them together in a black American limousine driving in County Meath, and when I saw those two characters, I knew exactly what they were.
That is quite a detailed description. Now, Paddy was fully aware that there were some who might roll their eyes while simultaneously raising their eyebrows. Not least, Joe Duffy.
Is this the first time you've spoken publicly about this?
Yes, yes.
But have you told your friends?
I did discuss it with one or two people.
And what was their reaction?
I don't know. I think they might have been ready to call the fellas with the white coats.
Not the men in white.
The men in white, yeah. I, to be honest with you, I wouldn't blame them.
However, Paddy was about to get some scientific pushback in the form of physicist and lecturer at Technological University Dublin, Dr. Kevin Nolan.
The chances of an alien spacecraft visiting Earth are very low. Now, we do think there's life in the universe. There might be upwards of billions of Earth-like planets out there, but it's unbelievably hard to get here. And there are lots of other kind of natural phenomena we do see. In fact, there's so many satellites even in orbit now, and some of them crashing, that people may even be witnessing, you know, parts of artificial satellites coming to the ground, as well as unusual phenomena. So the notion that maybe somebody might be encountering a UFO as an alien spacecraft is, you know, I'm giving the scientist viewpoint, quite low. You can never say never, and no scientist would ever say never, but it is very low.
Paddy, though, was having none of it.
Let me play hardball and say, not one single UFO account can produce evidence to a global audience.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to say is that's the problem.
Maybe that's what these people are relying. It doesn't blow their cover. For whatever reason that they're here, if they are here for some reason, and I think they are here for some reason, and that's what they're relying, that is so crazy that it's unbelievable.
As I say, my hardball hat on, I'll say, I mean, we have to question what's more plausible, the accuracy of the account, or that there are aliens here who don't want to be visibly seen. And I think most people will just say...
They are here. Yeah. I guarantee you they are here.
What is their intent?
I don't know, but I believe it's surveillance.
Now, as a physicist, Kevin Nolan was ruling nothing out. It's a great big universe after all. But really?
We're into the area of conjecture now, and all I'm trying to tell you is that from our understanding of science, which is very good, it is immensely hard. We don't even think we can ever get something the size of a spaceship we see in science fiction movies ever to other stars, like ever. Like the amount of energy needed to move a spaceship from here to Proxima Centauri would need more energy than the sun
produces. That's us, Kevin. We are talking about our physical world and what we can accomplish. Who are we to say that there are other entities out there that are way beyond even our comprehension?
Yeah, but Paddy, that's, as Kevin said, that's conjecture. Who's to say?
Of course it's conjecture. But why have so many people like myself in different parts of the world? Surely we're not all hallucinating.
No, nobody's saying hallucinating.
We're seeing something similar.
Liveline on Wednesday. Meanwhile, Ray Darcy was cutting a rug with Dr. Peter Lovett, the wonderfully named Dr. Dance.
What's the evolutionary value of dancing, Peter?
Oh, dancing is fantastic. There is no society anywhere in the world where the people don't dance naturally. Right. Little tiny babies groove. Now, we know that when people dance together, it bonds societies together. It bonds people together. Now, there's a brilliant study which found that when people move together in time, they afterwards, even complete strangers, report liking each other more, they trust each other more, they feel more psychologically similar, and they show more helpful behaviour towards each other, even little tiny children and adults. So dancing bonds societies together.
What happens in the brain then when we're dancing?
Oh, all kinds of things happen in the brain. So, we know, for instance, that people's pain thresholds go up when they dance. So when you dance, it can release opioids in the brain, and that can do all kinds of amazing things. We know that it makes us happy, so we know we're triggering some happy areas of the brain, but we know also these opioid receptors become more active, and that means that people's pain thresholds go up.
Nice.
Now, of course, this is fantastic in all kinds of ways, not just for dancing at 3 a.m. in a pair of stilettos, which must be very painful, but also when you're carrying all kinds of pain in your body, then dancing can help relieve some of that pain. And then let's imagine your relationship is characterized by frustration and a bit of anger and short-temperedness.
Yes.
Obviously, what you need to bring in is some fun and engagement and enjoyment. And sometimes we can use dance to help people find that joy. We can get people smiling again and making eye contact with each other, as you would in a nightclub or a disco.
That's our cue. That's it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. And be upstanding for this old school classic.